All right, so I'm going to start by summarizing very briefly the contents of Tho's lecture, which is going on in parallel right now. And it's very simple. If you want to write for Mises.org, just email Tho. So with that being said, let's get into it. So I'm going to talk about how China went from one of the poorest countries in the world to the world's second largest economy, and how this happened and how this looks from an Austrian perspective. This is not a talk about economic theory, it is a talk about economic history. But first, a brief disclaimer. This presentation is not primarily about Mao's Cultural Revolution. It's not about Tiananmen Square. It's not about the social credit score. And it's not about China being a police state. There's a lot of talk about that. This talk is instead about another aspect of China that often goes neglected and underreported in our circles. It's a lecture about China's economic growth, how China successfully adapted free markets for its own purposes and achieved so much. So China really went through a hard time in the 20th century that is comparable to few other countries on Earth. After the fall of the Qing dynasty, a very unstable nationalist government came to power. This government had leaders like Sun Yat-sen who supported ideals of democracy. He had this idea of all five races of China, the five main ethnic groups, living in harmony under a single democratic state, which would provide for equality. However, this regime was weak, and starting in 1916, it began collapsing, and warlords started taking power and seizing large chunks of territory. In 1927, the communists were expelled from the ruling Kuomintang party, and this resulted in a civil war. So from 1927 to 1936, China was in civil war. However, the Japanese invasion of 1937 put a hold to this, as the communists and the Kuomintang temporarily came together to push back the Japanese invasion. This invasion is probably one of the most brutal and least talked about war crimes. The Japanese committed serious crimes against humanity. During an event known as the Rape of Nanjing by modern people in China, the Japanese may have killed as many as 300,000 civilians, and more than 20,000 women were raped, women, children, elderly women. Ultimately, from 1937 to 1945, 20 million Chinese people died in the war. 15 million civilians were injured. These are figures that are comparable to the amounts of deaths on the Eastern Front during World War II. You always hear about how horrible the conditions were in the Soviet Union for the Germans and the Soviet soldiers and the civilians who were caught in the middle of that. Well, what was happening there is very similar to what happened to China. There were 95 million refugees, one of the biggest refugee crises in human history. However, after World War II, the chaos and the disorder and the bloodshed and the suffering did not stop. In 1945, barely had World War II ended, the Civil War immediately picked up, and there was a period of especially brutal fighting from 1946 to 1947, and some remaining conflicts on the mainland until 1950. During this time, about an additional, throughout the whole Civil War from 1927 to 1950, 15 million civilians died on top of the World War II casualties, and 2.5 million of the deaths were from the period from 1945 to 1949. After this, the communist regime took over, led by Mao Zedong. And Mao's regime had a horrible system of central planning. And immediately, there was a number of inhumanities that were committed against property owners, against landlords, against people who were deemed to have been affiliated against the bourgeoisie. And the government also severely mismanaged the economy, which resulted in the worst crisis of which makes the Civil War and World War II pale in comparison to the amount of death toll inflicted by central planning. These central planning policies essentially nationalized all of the lands and nationalized every single major industry in China. And as a result, something between 15 to 45 million people died. The highest estimates go as high as 60 million, with the mean estimates being around 30 million dead. I have two interesting anecdotes to illustrate how the centrally planned economy affected the Chinese population. First of all, in there was this annual thing that had been going on for many centuries, where the sparrows would come and eat a certain percentage of the crop. So the Chinese government put a bounty to kill the sparrows. As a result, the sparrows were overhunted and went extinct. This resulted in higher crop yields in the early 1950s, but a few years later, the population of locusts went out of control. And as a result, the ecosystem was thrown out of balance, and whatever, you know, damage was caused by the birds was far greater than, was far lesser than the damage caused by the insects. There's a particularly touching story that really affected me, where there's an American missionary who's in China at the time, and he's going through a forest. And while he's going through this forest, he's being led on by his guide, and he asks his guide why there's no animals in the forest. And the guide explains that they were overhunted because the famished population went out to the woods and hunted and ate any animal they could find because they were so desperate. And he noticed later on that a lot of the trees along the side of the road had the bark that was missing. And the guide explained that the bark had been scraped off by hungry people in an attempt to chew the bark to sort of alleviate their hunger pains. So the result is that there was a lot of unrest as a result, and there was a lot of chaos and a lot of hatred, and people really were looking for someone to blame for these problems. And instead of blaming central planning, Mao's government, and whether to the extent to which Mao's government promoted or opposed the Cultural Revolution is still a very controversial topic. But either way, Mao strengthened his cult of personality, and while at the same time he did grudging reforms, he began really cracking down on people who were deemed to be traitors to the revolution. There were anti-corruption crackdowns, which arrested thousands of government officials. There were purges, and we'll go into one of these purges in particular a bit later. There was an estimated 1.5 million casualties. That's the mean figure. 1 million to 2 million are the ranges of civilians who are killed as a result of the Cultural Revolution. One example is that Mao Zedong announced a policy of let 1,000 flowers blossom. What this meant is that there'd be freedom of speech on college campuses. So all of the people who had things that say that were critical of the regime started speaking out on the campuses. And as a result, the agents for the government took everyone's names down. And the next summer, they were all killed. So that's the Cultural Revolution. Finally, the trouble that China ran into came to an end. Throughout the 70s, Mao started growing old, and his health was beginning to ail. And as this happened, he delegated more control to some of the people who were his underlings. The situation started improving. But it finally came ahead when Mao died in 1976. And now we're going to talk about China's incredible rebirth from what has been probably the worst series of inhumanities in all of human history to also having one of the most economic growth periods in all of human history, probably only comparable to the European countries in the 19th century rapidly industrializing. So there you can see Mao on the right. Sorry, I mislabeled, but you can see Mao and Deng Xiaoping. Deng Xiaoping is a very interesting figure. He would assume control of the Chinese government after Mao's death. So Deng Xiaoping was part of a Hakka, which is a non-Han minority, which traditionally had suffered a lot of oppression under the Chinese government. He was born in 1904 in Paifang, which is in Chongqing, sort of in the south but central China, if you can imagine this. He was Western educated. In 1921, he joined the European Communist League. He was educated in Paris and to a greater extent in Moscow. However, in 1927, when the Chinese Civil War began, he decided to return to China and fight. And he fought for years, decades in China. He fought the Kuomintang as well as the Japanese and became a war hero. As a result, in 1952, he became the Minister of Finance. And he held high-level government positions during the Great Famine and the Cultural Revolution and the beginning of the Cultural Revolution. And he got to see a lot of the mistakes firsthand that were made by the communist government. However, he was viewed as being too liberal. He was always open to experimenting with different ideas and attempting new things which were not necessarily palatable to the Communist Party. So in 1966, he was purged. He was sent out, he was forced to retire, and was sent out to work in a very distant province in China. There were also some serious crimes that were inflicted against him and his family. His son was thrown from a four-story building and his back was broken in 1968, and his son had to spend the rest of his life as a paraplegic. So Mao did not want Deng to live. Mao wanted Deng dead, or at the very least, he wanted him out of his way. However, all of that changed in 1974 because Mao had discovered several plots against him within his ruling party and had been forced to get rid of a lot of other high-level ministers. So he brought Deng Xiaoping out of exile and decided to temporarily leave Deng in power just so that Deng could help manage things for a few years while he found a replacement. However, Mao has a stroke and dies in 1976, and Deng still remains in this high-level position. Here, you can see Mao starting to make initial negotiations with Henry Kissinger in 1974. Mao had been very interested in opening up to America to a limited extent, especially for military purposes, as China had had its own issues and conflicts with both the Vietnamese government as well as the Soviet government. So in 1976, after Mao's death, there's a power struggle. And you can see a lot of these pictures where you look at the Soviet Union and they'll airbrush the people, they disappear out. So Deng Xiaoping, you know, he was no saint. He probably had a lot of people killed. He definitely fought very hard to come and enjoy his position of power. Here you can see at the very bottom is a picture of Mao's funeral in 1976. And at the top, you can see an airbrushed version where all of the people who Deng had killed had been airbrushed out. Either way, he becomes paramount leader, which is not an actual title in 1978. He never really was the president of China. There was no equivalent of prime minister. He sort of gave himself new titles for new roles, and he was sort of behind the scenes, and it was very clear that he was in charge, but it was never something that was as official as it was. In fact, there'd be other presidents who would serve during the time he would control. So the first thing he did in 1978 was he was very interested in reforming the Chinese economy. So he visited Singapore. Singapore at the time was one of the most vibrant free market economies in the world. Here, there's Lee Kuan Yew and Deng Xiaoping. Deng Xiaoping is the shorter one. Lee Kuan Yew is a very interesting political leader of the 20th century in and of himself. He's probably the person who had the most pro-free market reforms in the whole course of the 20th century. He turned Singapore from a small island into a bustling capitalistic metropolis. So I recommend everybody Googles Lee Kuan Yew on Deng Xiaoping. He has some very funny speeches where he talks about his meetings with Deng. And during this time, he explained that Deng had to remove communists from communist influence, and there were some communist infiltrators in the Singaporean government. In exchange, Singapore would help offer technical assistance. And in 1979, a year later, he visited Hong Kong, which was another city-state, which, like Singapore, was also a former British colony. And Hong Kong was still under British control at the time. This is Governor Murray McLeehouse, who is another big free market reformer. He also helped turn Hong Kong into a very vibrant economy. And there's some very good videos from the 1980s of Milton Friedman talking about how dynamic and how capitalistic the Hong Kong economy is. And after he'd visited these two free market economies, Deng Xiaoping started having some ideas about how he could take these two countries that were both Singapore was something like 60 or 70% culturally Chinese, you know, Hong Kong was almost entirely Chinese, and make capitalism work for his Chinese audience. So this is the Special Economic Zones program and is ultimately one of the key tools that Deng Xiaoping was able to use to create such a vibrant capitalistic economy. So here you can see he created four initial special economic zones. Shenzhen is the most famous, right outside of Hong Kong in 1984. Over the years, he expanded the program to make 14 more zones and included major cities like Shanghai. By the 1990s, by the late 1990s, depending on what you count as special economic zones, because there are certain things that like are maybe export-import zones, there's between 1,250 and 2,000 special economic zones across China. So what did these special economic zones have? They had five key reforms that really made a huge difference. First, they had a wide variety of tax incentives so that foreign businesses had to pay a lot less taxes. It was a lot more lucrative looking. There was a partial independence from the central government on trade issues, where the municipal governments of the special economic zones had the ability to determine things such as tariffs to a limited extent. So this allowed free trade with the outside world. Construction and various projects were undertaken using private foreign capital instead of domestic Chinese government capital. Labor laws were eased up, so it was easier for foreign companies to hire and fire people. Although there were still people who were working for other people under communism, they didn't use the word hiring, and they had a whole framework to avoid sounding too capitalistic. And finally, they had limited property rights and property protections for foreign companies. So foreign companies had an assurance that if they built a factory 10 years down the line, it wouldn't just get nationalized and taken back by the Chinese government. Here you can see a picture of Shenzhen. The top picture is from 1964, and the bottom picture is like 2016 or something like that. So entire cities have popped up where these special economic zones were. Here you can see Shanghai, which had been a very ancient city, but Shanghai also experienced a huge economic growth. That's the Pudong district. If you go there now, I was just there last year. It's very nice. It's not at all, you know, like dirty or industrial looking, but it's like a lot of greenery, a lot of very walkable places, you know, bike paths. It's a kind of city where you want to walk around, which is not at all what most Americans imagine when they think of China. So in addition to that, Deng Xiaoping also helped prompt widespread economic reform throughout the Chinese economy, and some of his successors continued this tradition as well. So the Cultural Revolution slowly came to an end throughout the 70s. It kind of wound down as Mao started relinquishing power to his other officials, but it came to a definitive end on December 18, 1978, with the third plenum of the 11th Central Committee, which simply was a policy established to seek truth from facts. And during this, what was so interesting is that Deng Xiaoping criticized Mao in his speech and sort of broke the cult of personality. And later on in Deng's career, he would say quotes such as, "It doesn't matter if a cat is black or white, so long as it catches mice." Here there's a very iconic picture of China, and this is still probably the China that most, or at least that I think that a lot of Americans think of when they imagine China. But this is China in 1980. This is not really reflective of the modern realities. But in all cases, you see a wide variety of economic reforms throughout the 1980s. There's a lot of student exchanges with foreign countries to bring in, quote, foreign experts. The Chinese economy refocuses itself on international trade and exportation. There also was agricultural reform, which is one of the first things Deng Xiaoping did. They wanted to avoid what was euphemistically called the disaster of 58, 59, which had resulted in millions of dead. So in order to reform the economy, they first implemented a dual price system, where there'd be the first price, which would be the price that would be sort of the official price that everybody would see, which was the price of the state-run companies, and they would have a second price that would be floating on the market, which they would allow. They also divided people's communes, where the land had been communized during the 1950s, into private plots under a policy called the household responsibility. And these private plots were basically still part of this commune, but each family could independently manage their plot. And by 1984, 98% of farms were under the household responsibility system. They also tolerated, quote, specialized households, where certain farmers would be allowed to sell services, such as pest control and irrigation, on the market to the other households. As a result, you see a 25% increase in agricultural production from 1975 until 1985. Agricultural commons no longer focused on general productivity, and instead signed contract with other communes to sell their produce. and rural economic unions allowed entrepreneurs to come together and sort of form what we could call a primitive corporation and sell products. You also start seeing the somewhat privatization of the textile industry in the special economic zones, where foreign European and American companies would come and produce various plants. At first, it was mostly textiles, but over time, it evolved to include just about everything. And these plants would be mostly owned by foreign owners, and as a result, it employed a huge amount of people. By 1985, 85% of the population was working in the industrial sector. There also was an incredible liberalization of consumer markets. And throughout the 1980s and to a greater extent in the 1990s, the Chinese consumer was really empowered and a wide variety of choices started appearing. So first of all, you can look at, for example, international flights. In 1979, the first direct flight to Amsterdam appeared. By 1990, there were flights to every major city in America and Europe from China. China also became a country which not only exported, but also began importing products. Imports made up 15% of the economy in 1980, 21% of the economy in 1984, and 35% of the economy in 1986. And one last indicator that I like to look at just to see how capitalistic a country is whether or not fast food has penetrated the country. So yes, in 1984, the first KFC opened, and by 1994, 10 years later, there were 28 KFCs. And in 1990, you see McDonald's. The first supermarket opened in 1984. So it was China really liberalized and really grew economically, even looking at other metrics that are not, you know, necessarily GDP. There'd been a Shanghai Stock Exchange for a long time. However, in 1990, from 1990, it's really when it started, but it really took effect in 1992. The Shanghai Stock Exchange was for the most part privatized. Today, the Shanghai Stock Exchange is the fourth largest stock exchange in the world with a $5 trillion market cap, or 6.25% of world GDP. And as a result, at first when this happened, the Chinese currency experienced some inflation. However, the inflation rate fell. In 1995, there was a 17% inflation rate. And in 1996, there was only an 8% inflation rate. So has this privatization worked out? Well, the evidence suggests that yes. Here you can see China's GDP growth over the last few years. There were some years that were particularly important in terms of GDP growth. There was an 8.9% GDP growth in 1997, 7.8% GDP growth in 1998, and 7.1% GDP growth in 1999. So really, China's free market liberalization was extremely successful, resulted in a lot of wealth creation, a lot of prosperity for a lot of people. And even though Austrians have many very good criticisms of GDP, I think that when you combine sort of this along with the other numerous things like, you know, fast foods that you're looking at, it really paints a picture of a vibrant economy. So for the most part, these reforms came to an end in 2005 when Chinese President Hu Jintao put an end to a lot of this Deng Xiaoping reforms. However, the current governments are still supporters of the mixed economy. Although they use the word communist a lot, there's a lot of liberalization, but there's also a lot of things that are going the other direction now as well. And it's no longer that China is unambiguously going towards free markets. And where China is now in terms of on the, you know, capitalism to complete central planning spectrum is still very ambiguous. So recently, in the last decade, since 2012, China has begun exporting its process. So just as special economic zones helped reform the Chinese economy, China is now financing special economic zones all around the world, in Africa, in Latin America, in the Middle East, in Southeast Asia, in Central Asia. So to basically understand the economics of the Belt and Road, China needs natural resources. These resources come from Africa, Southeast Asia, and from Latin America. These resources are used to fuel its manufacturing economy, and it exports most of its goods to European and American markets, as well as Australia to a lesser extent. So the Belt and Road is a series of special economic zones to facilitate these Chinese supply chains that have been built all over the world. These include airports, oil pipelines, roads, fiber optic cables, SEZs, business parks, ports, railroads, just about everything you can imagine across something like 50 or 60 countries. The Chinese government has already spent roughly $1 trillion on this project, and they're slated to spend about $2 trillion more. I've seen estimates vary, but if you look, you can find estimates as high as something like $15 trillion, although I'm not sure how credible that is, and I think that's just projected future expenses. Let's look at a few specific projects. There's the Korgas Special Economic Zone. It's a giant special economic zone that's over 1,000 square kilometers, and it overlaps the border of China and Kazakhstan. The Korgas Special Economic Zone has almost no taxes, no VAT, no corporate income tax, no capital gains tax. There's very little labor law, so it's very easy to hire and fire people. There's a one-stop regulatory shop, so all of the permits have been consolidated into a single permit. So people can just go there, get a universal business permit, and start doing business and not deal with any of the bureaucracy. There's free trade regulations in that there's reduced tariffs for import and exportation, as well as increased border customs checking time and customs clearance. There's the Port of Colombo, which is a $1.25 billion port in Sri Lanka. This is one of the largest ports in the world, and you can see the scale. You see that I included a 1 kilometer line in the bottom left, so you can see sort of how big the port is. And you can also see how big it is compared to the shipping containers. And that is to deal with a lot of the logistical issues of getting resources from Asia and the Middle East to China. They'll stop at the port of Sri Lanka and go through Southeast Asia. Another example would be the Sino-Zambian Economic Zone. This is a multi-facility special economic zone outside of Lusaka, the capital of Zambia. It does a wide variety of manufacturing. A very expensive tractor plant has recently opened there, and a wide variety of other industries. And not only is China is not just taking resources from Africa. It's a much more complicated and sophisticated relationship than that. There's a lot of nuance. They're building a lot of infrastructure that the Africans very desperately need. They're creating a lot of jobs, and they're also doing manufacturing. So that is the summary of my presentation. So I'm going to be taking questions now. All right. Oh. Yes.
So with the Belt and Road, or I guess the Special Economic Zone success within China before the Belt and Road Initiative, it kind of seems like the lesson which was learned by say, later leaders in China was that we can use certain tools, economic tools, to bring greater economic prosperity to our people and enhance the enforcement mechanism of our state. They could reach out and touch their citizens in ways in which they could not 40 years ago as the state apparatus. Is there not a concern, or should we not be concerned, or perhaps should we, that the Belt and Road Initiative is going to expand China's authoritarian regime's ability to reach out and touch people that are not Chinese?
So the question is, should we be concerned that China's Belt and Road Initiative is going to expand Chinese authoritarianism to people who are not Chinese? I think that this is a serious concern, and this is something that people at the Mises Institute, maybe if there's any students who are looking for topics to write about, this is something that you guys should look into. It's something very important. There's several examples of it already spreading. For example, there's non-Chinese citizens who are included under the Chinese social credit score in the Korgas Special Economic Zone, but that's the only case of that I know happening. And also there were some allegations that the Chinese government sponsored the African Union headquarters in Addis Ababa in Ethiopia, and several microphones were found. But that, once more, you know, I'm not unsure that the U.S. wouldn't do the same thing. Yes.
Yeah, so I know 5 or 6 years ago there were talks in Poland about doing a special economic zone. Have other countries apart from, you know, China really kind of taken on this model? Because it seems to be a sure path. I mean, Trump talks about bringing in manufacturing jobs. So I always thought do a special economic zone somewhere on the Gulf Coast or whatever, you know, something similar where we can reduce that. But do we see that similar model being adopted?
Yes, there's 2,200 special economic zones across 70 countries worldwide. 9,600 if you use the really broad definition of zones. And some of these zones, a lot of these zones are just sort of single operator zones and are kind of just a way for some cronies to like get some tax breaks or something like that. However, a lot of countries have some very good, very effective zone programs. I personally really like the zone program in Colombia, where any private company that has three square kilometers of contiguous land can apply for zone status. And there's like a menu of rules and regulations that their zone can get exempted from. And about 70% of these zones in Colombia are single operator, so it's just like one company. But 30% are business parks that are quite successful. And it contributes to a huge percentage of Colombia's GDP growth per year. I don't remember the exact numbers. And there's some failed zone programs in India, although there have been some limited successful examples. But for the most part, India's, of course, Dubai is the most famous example of a successful special economic zone. There's a lot of other really interesting success stories around the world. Does anyone have any other questions? Time for our last question. Yes, last question.
Are there not a few examples under the Belt and Road where China uses its ability to give out massive loans for these infrastructure plans to countries that they know will not pay them back just so that they can have them default and like take up new ports? Because I know there are a few cases of China using the Belt and Road to inevitably retake control of these ports from the countries that they're essentially loaning out the ability to create.
So does China sort of use the Belt and Road as an opportunity to issue predatory loans and take ports and collateral? So there's one very kind of, there's one case right now that's ongoing of this. There's only one case that I know of recently, and this is Kenya. The Kenyan government wanted to build a standard gauge railroad, and they wanted to hire Chinese companies to maintain its port. The Chinese government, actually the Chinese, I think it was the Exim Bank, offered to loan the Kenyan government that money. However, as a term and condition, they put one of their main ports in the escrow account. And now that Kenya, for some various internal political reasons that are quite complicated, can't pay back these loans, there's a risk that there's the port is somehow going to be handed over to Chinese investors. I think that is a distinct possibility. I think it is a distinct risk. However, whether or not it is comparable to things that, say, the IMF and the World Bank have been promoting for the last 50 years has yet to say. I think that it's good that there's more countries that can provide more competition and offer out the better deal, and hopefully we'll see these Chinese investments expand. I just think that these governments need to be extremely careful and extremely cautious when negotiating and getting the right terms.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.